Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is August 14th, 2004. Today's session number is BUB 2004-01. Today's speaker is Barbara Budd. The subject for today is Wilderness Philosophy, History of the Wilderness Act. Let's listen in.
I guess we can start now. So we can start on time. My name is Barbara Budd, actually. I don't often give my last name on the boat. People don't generally care as much. So I'm Barbara Budd, and I work with the Forest Service here in Chelan, and or Down Lake, actually. Although this is still considered Chelan by the post office. I brought along some information today about wilderness. This is the 40th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. It was signed on, I believe, September 9th in 1964. And so I brought some information about wilderness, and I wanted to give a little bit of history of the Act as well as some of the philosophy behind it. But before we get into that information, what I was hoping we would do is share a little bit about what we think wilderness is, what it does for us, what some of its qualities are, and then when we come to the end, we can see if that legal definition of wilderness is matching what we think it should. And that's what I was thinking we could do tonight. So I've got a nice green marker for the trees, right? I wanted to just have folks just popcorn out what you think about when you hear the word wilderness.
Unspoiled.
Pristine.
Isolated.
Well, slow down.
Roadless.
Clean air.
Set aside.
Wild no animals. Permanent human presence.
Protected wildlife.
I heard another one earlier.
I don't know what you wrote.
I wrote no permanent human presence.
Oh, I said wild animals.
Wild animals, okay.
Yeah. Protected wildlife.
Yeah, I'm not writing very large results. Other things.
Trees.
Yeah.
Trees
is
the
obvious.
Yeah, in our area, yes.
Not the one.
Hiking. No, Arizona, where they got something.
Vistas.
Vistas.
No motorized vehicles.
No motorized. How about just we say no motors? Because that includes chainsaws,
right.
Too. Right? Uh-huh. Okay, so no motors.
And on the rivers, not like in, I know in Oregon, the Rogue River, part of that, this wilderness, you can't go up by a boat.
On wilderness, right. No motorized boats.
I don't know how to express it in one or two words, but the concept of providing some sort of an environmental protective shield.
Scientific?
I think in terms of the rainforest that's been cut down and how that has contributed then to environmental changes worldwide.
Okay.
So wilderness I view as a protection.
Okay.
Of
environmental. I think environmental shield is a nice way to put that. How about, in addition to that, a scientific baseline for us to look at what happens when we don't disturb wilderness versus what happens when we do.
What is it versus? And then,
what is it? What else does it do for us? What when you go out in the wilderness, what do you get?
Inspired spirituality. Renewal.
going to say bugs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, here we go. Let's go. Let's get some of those things out.
Challenged?
Challenged.
Odd.
Never met anybody odd in the wilderness before, like the other odd, right? Okay. What else? Let me put something out there. How about dangerous?
I was just thinking fear of bears and cougars, but I...
Fear. Yeah.
Every trailhead now, you see.
I know.
Bear and cougar country, you
right.
will die.
Yeah, it's a little unnerving when you're first heading out.
Okay. Anything else?
This has more to do with what you have to be when you're out there. Self-sufficient.
Excellent. Yeah, what does wilderness make us do if we're in the wilderness, besides what it gives us? That's a good way to think about it. Yes.
Independence.
I think we have to be smart.
Smart.
Some sort of survival.
What we're doing here is we're just popcorning out anything that comes to our mind when we think of wilderness, whether it's how to describe wilderness, or what it does for us, or what it makes us be. So feel free to just hop in. You've got a pretty good list there.
What we should be, and not everyone is, though, is good stewards of the land, whether that's up there or not. I mean, you don't want to find orange peelings all along the way when you mine.
Good stewards. That's my favorite line.
Be thankful for the parts of the world that aren't spoiled by human habitation yet, that there's still something left that's natural and whole.
And that it belongs to the people.
Right.
Thankful. Okay. For the wilderness itself.
Right.
If you're not in the wilderness, do you get something from the wilderness?
Yeah.
What?
Well, it's just nice to know it's out there. Good to know it's out there.
They also get more practical benefits, too, like clean water, if the wilderness streams flow through the municipal watershed.
Clean water, you bet.
Airship or clean air. Salmon spawning habitat up there sometimes.
Unspoiled ecosystem.
Ecosystem. Okay. That's great. More? I'll continue writing. I think this is great. We feed each other when we think about these things. So I'll certainly love to keep going on this.
I don't know how you say it, because it's not necessarily public in that there's a lot of people around, but it isn't private.
It's public land, right. Anybody can go there. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can it be bought by individuals?
not private. No development. She's good.
The whole naturalness of it, how it really lives independently of people. Yeah.
Okay.
And it just, it operates by itself completely.
Self-sustaining, whatever.
Yeah. And the cycles that it has, like with fire. And the rebirth.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that what the politicians had in mind when they set it aside?
Well, let's find out. Let's find out. You can tell me. I've got a short PowerPoint presentation. And this actually, I'm going to ask your forgiveness, perhaps, or patience. This was actually designed for a slightly different purpose, so I'm going to skip around a little bit. So you might have to just put up with that. Can everybody see that?
Yep.
Because I'll shut off the lights if we need to.
No, that's fine.
Okay. All right. You know, and I forgot to ask. I've got a fairly loud voice, but if you need a listening assistive device, they're right there in the box. So my apologies for forgetting to mention that. Feel free there, or feel free just to say, holla. Okay. Okay, well, we'll talk a little bit about the Wilderness Act here. There's a vast, diverse network of wilderness areas to benefit many different people. And yet definitions of wilderness vary. Having a knowledge of the Wilderness Act can help us to understand how to use these areas and why they're set apart. The Wilderness Act is the guiding light of managers of legal wilderness. And even before the Wilderness Act of 1964, there were strong voices raised for preserving wildlands. Some were well known, some were more obscure. John Muir, Aldo Leopold, Bob Marshall, Marty Murray, and Harvey Broom. There was growing concern that the existing means of preserving wildlands were not enough to guarantee their future preservation as wilderness. And so as early as 1921, Aldo Leopold wrote about the need for a national policy to preserve wilderness areas. Bob Marshall echoed Leopold's statement in 1934. He said, in order to escape the whims of politics, areas should be set aside by act of Congress. This would give them as close an approximation to permanence as could be realized in a world of shifting desires. And in 1940, just a year after Marshall's death, Harvey Broom wrote from the Southeast, "Do you think wildernesses would have more permanence if there were some new status established by congressional enactment?" Well, 1950 proved to be the right time to act for legislation protecting wilderness. Energy and awareness had grown. There was a fight against the Echo Park Dam in Dinosaur National Monument that built a strong coalition of environmentalists. And public awareness of wildlands grew as transportation and tourism expanded after World War II. Now a leader in the Echo Park fight came to the forefront to the fight for legislatively protected wilderness. And this was Howard Zonizer, and he was known as Zonnie, and he became the principal author and promoter of the Wilderness Act. And he said, "The wilderness that has come to us from the eternity of the past, we have the boldness to project into the eternity of the future." he put his vision into writing, and he wrote in 1955 the first draft of the Wilderness Bill, which the bill was a vision in and of itself. And it was first presented to Congress in 1956, and then it passed the Senate twice, the second time in 1963, and it passed the House in 1964. And then it was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson on September 3rd. I was wrong, it was on September 9th. September 3rd, 1964.
Who was that one, do you
know? Yeah. Actually, the one was a first-year representative from Texas, and his name was Joe Poole.
Can you imagine a similar legislation passing this Congress with only one dissenting vote?
Yeah.
Well, now they have a wilderness here named after him.
Yeah.
No, they have a lake named after him.
There was a Rose Garden ceremony and a vision of wilderness preservation enacted there. The Wilderness Act, in many ways, is a very standard piece of legislation, but it's very poetic. There's lots of beautiful language in it. And it had a vision that held through all seven sections plus the preamble. And it did four things. It created a national wilderness preservation system. It defined wilderness. It established a process for designating wilderness areas. And it set provisions for managing the use of wilderness areas. Now, first it created the National Wilderness Preservation System. And the preamble states, to establish a national wilderness preservation system for the permanent good of the whole people and other purposes. And that pretty much summarizes the entire act, and it might be called the purpose of the act. Section 2 goes into more detail. For this purpose, there is hereby established a national wilderness preservation system to be composed of federally owned areas designated by the Congress as wilderness areas, in order to assure that an increasing population accompanied by an expanding settlement and growing mechanization does not occupy and modify all areas within the United States and its possessions, leaving no lands designated for preservation and protection in their natural condition. It is hereby declared to be the policy of the Congress to secure for the American people of present and future generations the benefits of an enduring resource of wilderness. Here's the purpose stated again, to secure for the American people an enduring resource of wilderness. Well, what is a resource of wilderness? It's physical, wildlife, plants and land, water, cultural resources, but it's also emotional, solitude, beauty, exploration, and adventure. Here's one we didn't have up there, adventure. Mm-hmm. But Congress doesn't secure just a resource, it secures the benefits of the resource. And we've talked a little bit about that, those benefits on the board, when we were throwing things out. But again, they're both physical and emotional. We've got habitat for endangered species, a sense of wildness, discovery, escape from everyday life, just knowing that it's there. Somebody said that. Author Wallace Stegner wrote that it's part of a geography of hope. And not just a resource for now, but an enduring resource for future generations. As Zani called it, a wilderness forever future. So this is the purpose that the system was established. Well, what is this wilderness to be secured? Definitions of wilderness have varied through history, and I've got a couple of fun ones we'll bring out later that talk about wilderness being a very dark and dreary and dangerous place, all the way to some very sublime definitions. And the Wilderness Act clarifies the definition in a legal document. And the tangible and intangible are both set into words. and some abstract concepts are very well defined. Section 2, Part C, intentionally divides it into two parts. The first is an abstract definition of wilderness, which is an ideal for people who are managing wilderness to strive for. And the other is a practical definition, realistic standards for wilderness designation. Well, the first sentence is the ideal abstract, and I'm going to apologize in advance. I want to remind folks that this was written in 1964, and so the language is not what we might expect to find today. So we'll go to the abstract. A wilderness, in contrast with those areas where man and his own works dominate the landscape, is hereby recognized as an area where the earth and its community of life are untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. And we talked about that. Somebody mentioned something very like that. Listening things. Now, it's not untrammeled. It's untrammeled. Okay? That's a very different word. And this was actually a word that had some contention around it. They tried to get Zani to change it from untrammeled to something else because it was so esoteric. But he said, the word untrammeled is one that came into use after, in its definition, after dissatisfaction with almost every other word that had been suggested. So he was right there. And so we'll look at what trammeled means. Well, the noun is a net for catching birds or fish, or it's a shackle for making a horse amble. Okay? Well, the verb is to catch or hold in, as if in a net, to prevent or impede the free play of. And maybe that makes a little more sense. So in Zani's words, it means not being subject to human controls and manipulations that hamper the free play of natural forces. So there's our the definition of untrammeled.
Can you tell us something about Zani, who he was? I mean,
sure. I don't know a ton about him. He was, he was an activist an environmental activist, mm-hmm. who started saying, he was one of the first to really put things in writing and say, this is the legislation that we need. And he pushed through the legislation, really pushed at it. He was not a politician, as far as I know, anyway. So I don't know a ton about him. Most of what I know about him, you will see tonight. So he's one of my... I'm exploring all of these folks myself these days. So I'm sorry, that doesn't help a lot. But he was an environmental advocate. Okay, well, we'll take a look at where untrammeled sits. And it refers actually to the earth and its community of life, not to the human experience within it. And it's not meant to be a word to determine suitability of land for wilderness designation. Instead, it applies to the future possibility of an area rather than its current or past use. And it seems to be the essence of the abstract definition of wilderness, that quality that's out there that's really hard to define. And he said, it's helpful to have written the bill some such expression that tries to give an impression of the quality of wilderness. Well, so then there's the second definition, the practical one. We'll go to the second sentence, of section 2C, and that's an area of wilderness is further defined to meet in this act an area of undeveloped federal land, retaining its primeval character and influence without permanent human improvements or human habitation, which is protected and managed so as to preserve its natural conditions and which generally appears to have been affected primarily by the forces of nature, with the imprint of man's work substantially unnoticeable, has outstanding opportunities for solitude or a primitive and unconfined type of recreation, has at least 5,000 acres of land, or is of sufficient size as to make practicable its preservation and use in an unimpaired condition, and may also contain ecological, geological, or other features of scientific, educational, scenic, or historic value.
And three, does sufficient size mean big enough or small enough?
Big enough.
Big enough.
Big enough to make practicable its preservation. So, and I can, I'll give you an example here. You pulled out what we've got is some ambiguous qualities, and I'll go through this slide, and I'll go to the next one, which answers your question, I think, or at least addresses what you're talking about. We've got some ambiguous qualifiers to allow all kinds of interpretation, so that we're not...
Lots of fudge words there.
Huh?
Lots of fudge words there.
Yeah, lots of fudge words.
Generally appears.
and there's number three. The first Department of the Interior site to be designated as wilderness in 1968 was the Great Swamp National Wildlife Refuge in New Jersey at 3,660 acres. So under 5,000 acres. And this means that when they're determining size, they use the word practicable, meaning feasible but not tested, as opposed to practical, which means tested and proven to be put into practice. So they look at an area and they say, you know, we think this can be self-supporting, what we were talking about, that it's self-contained, that it doesn't need, that this is big enough to contain whatever ecosystem is there. So it doesn't have to be as large as 5,000 acres. And the smallest wilderness area is the Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge. It's 5 acres. Mm-hmm. And that's in Florida. So does that kind of go to what you were talking about? Okay, so what words clarify wilderness? Anything that you don't recognize there? Untouched and pristine are not in the act. Those two words. The others are there. But untouched and pristine are intentionally absent. Congress and Howard Zonizer never intended for wilderness to be free from all human impacts. Many areas in the eastern USA that had been utilized by humans and still had clear signs of use and habitation were listed in the first 1955 draft of the bill for consideration, including Shenandoah National Park. And at qualifier number four states, as we looked at it, that they may contain features of scientific, educational, scenic, or historic value. So you might have some historic features in there, some possible signs of people, but we can't build a road to them. We can have a trail to them, but not a road. So in some areas of wilderness, we might see things like that pictograph, or any of these items that are in here. And certainly, through most of our wildernesses, we have trails, which are certainly signs of humans. But we all kind of accept them as part of what we need to be able to appreciate our wilderness. And certainly if we didn't have trails, we'd have many more trails. Because folks would create their own. So, even with the qualifier, Zani wrote, we describe an area as wilderness because of a character it has, not because of a particular use that it serves. So it's difficult to define both the physical and abstract portions of wilderness, but the Wilderness Act took a pretty good shot at it. Well, okay, so we've talked about the preservation system and the definition. But this also established a process for the National Wilderness Preservation System to grow. The system started out with all Forest Service land. There was 9.1 million acres of Forest Service land that was designated as wilderness areas at the signing of the Wilderness Act. Okay, and skip the next one. Okay, and Section 3 outlines the process for proposed areas to be considered for wilderness designation. So first, the secretaries report the recommendations to the president. Then the president advises Congress of recommendations, and then Congress acts. And that's how wilderness is designated. The act states several times very clearly that wilderness areas will only be designated by an act of Congress, by congressional affirmative action. And this was a huge compromise. This was kind of a last-minute concession on the Wilderness Act proponents' part, and originally, their idea was that the area would be automatically become designated as wilderness by proposal from the Secretary of the President. So as long as that worked out, then the only thing that could happen is that Congress could revoke the status through congressional veto within a certain period of time. But very quickly, they realized that they'd actually won a victory in making this compromise because it gave more strength to the public. And then there wouldn't be as much designation subject to political sway. And I love this quote. This quote happened, of course, Marshall died long before the bill was passed or even written, but this is a Bob Marshall quote that fits this very well. In order to escape the whims of politics, which might make the president of the American Automobile Association the next Secretary of the Interior, and Henry Ford the next Secretary. Okay, so it created the National Wilderness Preservation System and then established a way for it to expand. Now I'm going to skip a few. Well, there were some subsequent acts that kind of tied in, and most of them were applicable to all of the agencies involved in wilderness, including the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the National Historic Preservation Act, the ADA, NEPA, and the Alaska National Interest Lands Act. And Alaska's different. I don't know a lot about Alaska. I wish I knew more. Had I had a bunch more time to prepare for this, I'd have brought a whole bunch of Alaska information with, but they handle things a little differently. Some of their things are, because it's so vast, and because there were already roads established in certain areas, if one of the things in Alaska has something to do with it, if a road has been used historically for certain purposes, it can continue to be used. Even though it goes through what the rest of it would be wilderness. So there are other things that are very specific to Alaska that make it different from the wilderness that we have down here in the contiguous 48. Then we had the 1976 Federal Land Policy and Management Act, which directed the BLM to conduct wilderness reviews of all of its land. So then it went from, first it was Forest Service and then Park Service and Fish and Wildlife, and then we added the BLM. Then the Park Service had the Redwood National Park Act, and that had information in it about a non-degradation policy, so that there wouldn't be any degradation of the values and purposes for which the area had been established. Then the Forest Service had, in 1975, the Eastern Wilderness Act, and then the Endangered American Wilderness Act. And both of these encouraged the Forest Service to let go of this purity doctrine that was never really part of the original congressional intent. They didn't mean that lands needed to be pure, pristine, untouched by the sights and sounds of humans past or present in order to be designated in wilderness. instead it confirmed an untrammeled as an ideal for the future of the area, not a condition of current or past use, which allows us to do some interesting things as a result. We can take areas where people have been and kind of return them to their natural state and have them be wilderness. Well, due to these and many more subsequent acts, the National Wilderness Preservation System has grown substantially. There was, as I mentioned, 9.1 million acres in the fall of 1964. And now, almost 106 million acres, which is about 4% of all the land in the U.S. Now, as you can see, a very large part of that is in Alaska. So that is a huge resource for us, is that all of that land in Alaska.
Okay, what are the various colors we're looking at there?
I think it's years.
That looks to me like it might be
ownership. You're right. It's
purple
ownership.
Is Olympic and North Cascades National Park.
Yep. That's, you're just exactly right.
And maybe the orange is Fish and Wildlife.
Yep. And I've actually got this map up here. So if you want to take a look afterwards, you can look a little closer and you can see the different places. And yes, that's exactly what it is. We've got National Parks, Forest Service, Wildlife Refuge, and Bureau of Land Management.
What's the green one?
Forest Service.
That's what's around here. That's what's surrounding us, except for the purple one right above it, which is Park Service. That's North Cascades.
And you said that makes up 4% or
0.4? No, 4%
okay.
of the land in the United States.
Okay.
And again, that's it's 4% because we have so much in Alaska.
Okay.
The largest, matter of fact, the largest wilderness area is in the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park in Alaska. That's 9.7 million acres. That park itself is larger than all the land that was designated in the 1964 Act. And then we talked about the smallest, the Pelican Island National Wildlife Refuge in Florida. There are a few states without any wilderness: Rhode Island, Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Iowa, and Kansas. And this is where I'd ask that question I asked earlier, which is do the people who in these states have benefits from wilderness? And we talked a little bit about that. Wilderness areas are part of our, as Stegner said, our geography of hope. Different agencies manage all the different agencies manage the different lands slightly differently. So Forest Service will manage their wilderness just a little differently than the Park Service, differently than BLM, differently than Fish and Wildlife. So all of those areas are managed just a little bit differently, but they're all guided by the Wilderness Act.
Are you saying that all national forests is wilderness?
No.
It's like an overlay.
Yeah. It's, I'll show you on the map. Just get up and do that. Here we've got a map of the Wenatchee National Forest. Okay? And it's hard to see, but there are two different colors green. There's a dark green and a light green. And if it's hard to see, come on up afterwards and take a closer look. The dark green is wilderness. The light green are other Forest Service lands in the Wenatchee National Forest. The white is private land.
Which generally, and the lighter green generally have roads and have been logged or are open to logging.
Not necessarily.
For the most part?
Not necessarily. They Forest Service is a multiple use agency, and so yes, there are areas that are open to logging. There are areas that are used for grazing. Not too much anymore, but some. We've had mining on Forest Service lands. Again, not much anymore.
But we do also have roadless areas in our forest that have nothing to do with wilderness. Some of those roadless areas are open to, even though they have trails but not roads, and so they would be open to, they'd be open in some cases, not all, but in some cases to things like motorbikes. So they can have some motorized traffic, but not four-wheel drives or not cars or whatever. So, but not all roadless areas are open even to that. So we can have, and those things are all designated by forest plan. So they're not congressionally mandated roadless areas, but instead designated by the forest plan. In the Chelan, for example, in the Chelan Ranger District, we have an awful lot of land that isn't wilderness. There's very little logging here. And part of the reason there's very little logging here is because it's not economically feasible. But part of it is whether or not our ecology can support it. So it's determined both by some economics and by some ecology. Yeah. All right. A couple more slides here. I left my notes. Okay. So it is a very diverse system. And there are diverse perspectives on wilderness. But it all holds one thing in common, the Wilderness Act. And I don't know if I mentioned this. No, I don't think I did. Howard Zahnizer never lived to see the act signed. He died 4 months before it was signed, and so President Johnson shook his wife's hand at the signing ceremony. But he exemplified his own words. It's a bold thing for a human being who lives on the earth but a few score years at the most to presume upon the eternal. Yet we who concern ourselves with wilderness preservation are compelled to assume this boldness. Well, that's my PowerPoint. Seeing that, are there any more questions that I can answer?
From a practical standpoint, in looking at designation, is there a different standard applied in the East where so much greater share of the land has been subject to human settlement than in the West where we have much more land that was relatively untouched at the time the law was passed?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And as you can see, there's actually, if you look at this map, you can see that the vast majority of our lower 48 wilderness is over here in the West.
So that's where the federal lands are.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's also, I mean, there are parks in the East, mm-hmm. but this was also where we had untouched lands to begin with. And so that was that's part of it. I wanted to share a little bit with you too about what the wilderness is that surrounds us here. Holden Village and Stehekin are surrounded by wilderness. We've got on this map, here's that light green area I was talking about right here. This is Holden Village. Okay, and this dark green area all around here is the Glacier Peak Wilderness. This is the Lake Chelan Sawtooth Wilderness. It goes all the way down to here. Glacier Peak just puts a little tongue out there and then comes back in. So it just barely touches the lake. And then up in here, up around Stehekin, we have the Stephen P. Mather Wilderness. And that's part of not all of North Cascades National Park is wilderness, but a large portion of it is, and that's the Stephen P. Mather part. And that actually dips down into the Lake Chelan Recreation Area a little bit, National Recreation Area there. So part of the park and part of the National Recreation Area, both of which are managed by the Park Service, have wilderness in them. The Glacier Peak Wilderness, which is what surrounds us here, it's kind of a mile in any direction,
That started in 1964 as 56,000 acres. And in 1984, there was the Washington Wilderness Act, and it was the 56,000 acres were added by the 1984 Act to a total of 577,000 acres. The Lake Chelan Sawtooth Wilderness was totally created by the 1984 Act, and it's 146,000 acres. Now, these wildernesses span the boundaries of districts and forests. So some of the Glacier Peak Wilderness is actually in a different national forest. It's part of the Mount Baker-Snoqualmie National Forest. Several ranger districts are involved. But on the Chelan Ranger District, which is the district that Holden is part of, we have 200,000 acres of wilderness between Glacier Peak and the Lake Chelan Sawtooth. So we have 200,000 acres just on this district, and another 100,000 acres of roadless areas. So we have a quite a large area of roadless, and those roadless areas then would not be logged. Designated again by forest plan, not Congress. Talked about the Mather Wilderness to the north. Factoid, this is kind of cool, between Highway 2 coming down through Leavenworth, okay, and Highway 20 going through North Cascades National Park, 1.25 million acres of wilderness. It's the Henry M. Jackson Wilderness besides the three I've already mentioned, Glacier Peak, Lake Chelan Sawtooth, and Stephen the Mather. So, yeah.
I have a question about how big, like, is an acre? Like, the village here, like, with the buildings, like, I mean,
how do you
describe how big an acre is? Like, with using football fields, or?
I never really thought about it that way. Anybody else thought about it that way?
Acre is 40-some thousand square feet.
Right, because it's just hard for me to picture,
yeah,
like, how much.
Yeah, right.
So how many acres to a square mile, then?
Is it
36.
No.
It's 640.
Yeah, that's right. 640 acres to a square mile.
Okay,
if that helps. Yeah, that's easier for me to do that math than the other. Yeah, 640 acres to a square mile.
Okay.
Uh-huh. All right. Yeah. Yep. So,
I have a question.
Sure.
I noticed this map goes from 64 to 89. Is it that not many have been added since then?
Yeah.
Have any been added?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that, and certainly we've had nothing added here in Washington since 1984.
Mm-hmm. And so, I'm guessing
didn't
we're
Clinton
probably...
Didn't Clinton designate some things just before he left office? Or was that... No.
I don't think it was wilderness because it's a congressional, it's an act of Congress. It wouldn't.
Okay, they were preserves or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's an act of Congress, though, as suggested by the president through that process.
Yes, suggested by the process, and then it goes through and Congress acts,
right,
and then the president signs it into law. Yeah.
But there's presidential recommendation that goes through.
Yes, yep, there is. My understanding is that we haven't had any wilderness since then. So,
yeah, I don't know much about it, but there is somewhat of a controversy, and I don't know where it stands right now. It started earlier this year in terms of, I think it's the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness area, but it might be a roadless area in Montana, where... there are mining companies that want to mine, take minerals out from underneath, and they are saying, I mean, the deal is that the wilderness area is on top, not underneath.
Whoa.
Let's see. You should have made another section.
You know,
probably like,
I don't know anything about that one.
It's probably because maybe the mineral rights predated, I mean, federal government often sold mineral rights in the old days. Like, I don't own the mineral rights under my house. You know, most of us don't.
Yeah,
and see, I'm not...
But
that's why I'm just kind of talking about it if somebody else knew about it. But I do know
But there is that controversy.
Yeah,
where it's sitting right now, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I would imagine they would have a really hard time putting a building on that land, because I think on top of the land, of course, that would be wilderness, and they couldn't put anything out there. It would take an act of Congress for them to put something there.
You couldn't use your machines.
It's amazing how they can get around it.
Yeah.
But you think, oh, there's no way they can do that, and then suddenly you find out that, well, they're going to do such and such. Up the river or something, I don't know.
And again, I don't know if this particular controversy that you're talking about, but a lot of that is around Alaska. A lot of those kinds of controversies are happening in Alaska, partly because the law is different for Alaska. Mm-hmm. So there are different ways of doing things there that I don't know a lot about.
Well, the Cabin Mountains are in northern Montana.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I'm curious, just from a practical standpoint, as Forest Service people who manage this wilderness, what kind of challenges you face and what kind of conflicts you have to deal with? Because just because it's wilderness doesn't mean you can just leave it alone.
Yeah. You know what? Are you going to be here Monday?
No.
Okay. There's a woman coming up here who is on the Chief's Advisory Council, the Forest Service Chief in Washington, his advisory council on wilderness. And she would be the woman to answer that question, because she manages wilderness. I don't.
I wonder, I mean, we just, you know, we came through several days through the Glacier Peak, and we were noticing, you know, old batteries that people had discarded, and there's evidence in some places of overuse, even in isolated areas.
I can tell you my experience as a ranger last year. I was a wilderness ranger up at Lyman Lake, okay? And the challenges that I faced there were cleaning up after people, a lot of cleaning up after people, trying to get people to, certainly we have, part of the, you know, we have some very, what some people would describe as unpleasant looking campgrounds that have been very heavily used. But you know what those campgrounds do? They do exactly the same things that the trails do. They keep that heavy use concentrated. And so I had several discussions with folks, just trying to let them know when they didn't want to stay in that campground, what they're not staying in that campground and then going to camp someplace else was going to do to the environment. And while it's legally their right, in Forest Service, Park Service manages things differently, but in Forest Service managed wilderness, it's legal to camp anywhere. It's unless there's a legal restriction, like certain lakes, it's 200 feet from the lake or whatever. Unless there's a legal restriction, it's legal to camp anywhere. It's also legal to have a campfire pretty much anywhere you want, unless, like last summer, we had a legal closure on campfires for the whole forest, or for the whole wilderness, kind of. And so some of that is education of the public. How do we teach people that by making a fire someplace that there hasn't been a fire already, you're scarring yet another piece of land, that you're burning the duff, that you're actually potentially creating hazard, because we don't know what's underneath there. We don't know if there's a root under there that's going to catch fire and go start a fire someplace else. So there's a lot of education that happens by folks who are on the trail crew, by folks who are out there doing wilderness ranger stuff. That sort of thing happens a lot. And not everybody believes in wilderness. Not everybody believes in it. All of the controversies about whether or not they should let motorized boats into the Boundary Waters canoe area, for example, in Minnesota. Not everybody believes that's an appropriate use of the land. And so, again, education there. So that would be my answer from my experience. Undoubtedly, there's a much deeper answer.
Yeah. When you mention that, just that, when you say that they can camp wherever they want to. Excuse me. The Himalayas National Forest outside of, it's sort of in between and west of Albuquerque and Santa Fe in New Mexico. It is not a wilderness area.
Okay.
But you can camp wherever you want to.
Yep.
And it has become so popular, and exactly what you're saying has happened.
Yep.
You can hardly find a grassy spot because people from Alamosa and Santa Fe come down and people from Albuquerque go up. And I don't know if it's true, but I talked to somebody who had talked to the ranger. We never saw the ranger. But said that they were going to close that off next summer. The road was going to be closed so that it could
restoration
regenerate. Yeah.
Yep.
The erosion is terrible.
Is
it bad over here?
That's another area. Yeah. Well, this is just, it's not roadless, it's not a wilderness, but it's pretty open, undeveloped. It's an undeveloped area. There's no dead, and that's what I thought. I thought, well,
right.
If they had a few designated places,
yeah,
you'd be out of luck if those places were already camped in, but at least it would control it somewhat.
And we do actually close areas, even in the wilderness now here, we do close areas for restoration. If you're up at Lyman, you'll see that. You'll see some areas closed for restoration. So that will happen.
Barbara?
Yeah?
Are all wilderness areas, I realize the ones that fall in national parks are managed differently, but all of the ones that fall under the Forest Service lands, are they managed similarly, like, say, in California and Washington and Oregon?
One would hope.
Okay.
There are certain rules that apply to all of them. Whether or not those rules are enforced is, I don't know. I would hope they would be. There are some minimum standards right now, the woman who's coming on Monday would know, again, more than about this, so if you happen to see her, she's going to arrive. She's not going to arrive until Monday, so unfortunately, those of you who aren't going to be here. She was talking a little bit about an initiative that they've got to, within the next 10 years, have all wilderness managed to this minimum standard. And so I think there are some things that are true to all wilderness, but it maybe doesn't meet this minimum standard. So there are differences, certainly. Right now, I think they were talking about this minimum standard. Right now, about 8% of our wilderness is managed to that standard.
Yeah,
something like that.
I think what set my mind to thinking when you talked about the ban on fires last year here, in California, I don't think you can have a campfire in any of the wilderness areas.
And that has to do with the conditions. Our wilderness area up here is usually wet enough and cool enough because it's so high up that having campfires isn't a threat to life and safety. And I would imagine in California that just is not the case. That the potential for wildfire is very great. This was the first campfire closure we had, I believe, since the wilderness started, with one possible exception in the 80s, and I'm not positive about that one. And so it was the first time that this particular wilderness had ever been closed to fires. And it was because the Mount Baker snow calming side of the Glacier Peak closed. And they closed because they had much greater vegetation, but they had an incredibly dry year. So even though we were about at the same level of dryness, they had more vegetation, and they were at a greater greater risk for fire as a result. And while we didn't have a huge risk for fire, we had a large risk, but not as huge as theirs. We had to close because our border is so long. And so that was part of the issue of us closing last year, even though it was probably a really good thing for us to do so.
Is there a campfire closure now in the wilderness?
There's none.
Really?
There is none.
Huh. That's curious.
Mm-hmm. But yet the wilderness boundary is just right up the trail here by the Wall Diamond.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. All Forest Service lands in this district right now that are not in the wilderness are restricted to campfires are restricted to the metal rings, the developed sites. Yeah. Well, are we meeting what we asked for? Does the law?
If it's enforced.
Sort of.
I certainly see a difference in all the hiking I've done in Yosemite and in other wilderness areas. the first time I stepped out of the wilderness and into Sequoia National Forest.
Stepped into something.
The first lake we came to, there were these cattle, you know, mucking up the shore. And there were camp sites, but you know, I wasn't going to stay there. You know. I thought, good grief, is this the way the Forest Service does things? You know?
It's that whole idea of multi-use. We have public lands that are used for very different things.
Yeah, yeah. Now whenever I see a sign saying so-and-so National Forest, land of many uses. Yeah, too many.
Well, I do want to end on time for those of you who want to leave. Those of you who want to stay and chat, I'm happy to do that. So, thank you for coming.